This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Okay, great. Welcome to University of California, Santa Barbara. This is one of many events sponsored and run by the Carsey Wolf Center for Film, Television, and New Media. And it's also co-sponsored by the Santa Barbara County Air Pollution Control District. I'd like to briefly introduce Mr. Leo Kay. He was sworn in as the Communications Director for the California Air Resources Board in July 2007 as a political appointment to the Schwarzenegger administration. Since then, he's spearheaded efforts to communicate to the board's efforts to curb greenhouse gas emissions under California's landmark climate change law, AB 32. They don't actually call it the landmark AB 32 law, but it is the one. He's also worked to publicize all the precedent-setting regulations ARB is passing in terms of cutting diesel pollution throughout the state. Prior to joining the Resources Board, he ran the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's media office in San Francisco. He's also served as the agency press officer in Boston prior to transferring back to the West Coast, just one of many forms of evidence of his genius, realizing that returning back to the West Coast is a good thing. He also served in the U.S. Coast Guard for 5 years, and he has he's written hundreds of articles on environmental issues, also including 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, and the Space Challenger disaster. He's going to talk about how he uses a variety of media to explain the Air Resources Board and also the legislation. And this is the country's first regulatory program to curb greenhouse gas emissions, certainly at the state level. And as you know, this is in some conflict with the national program, so we're really leading the fray here. So he's going to talk about a variety of issues, including the issue of issues. Mr. Leo Kay.
Great. Thank you, Ron. It's great to be here. You know, I got up this morning, I think, slept in till 7, which is a real luxury for me. I commute from the Bay Area, I carpool from the Bay Area to Sacramento every day, so I have a long day when I'm back in Northern California. But getting up here in Santa Barbara, the weather was cooperating, got to go for a run on the beach. If you guys are looking for additional employees down here or anything, you might want to consider me. You know, I have an interesting communication study to talk to you about today. The issues we'll discuss has all the elements that you would want in terms of generating interest. So we're talking about polar bears possibly going extinct, polar ice caps melting, huge potential public health and economic impacts in California. I mean, you know, the future of the human race is in peril. This is a huge, huge deal. It's a big, big issue for our generation. So, you know, there should be no problems, right? I mean, it's all there. Well, yes and no. Over the next 30, 45 minutes or so, we'll talk about California's climate change program, the unique challenges we face in communicating the Air Resources Board progress in meeting our goals, and the issue of how we are trying to affect behavioral change household to household via social marketing. By way of background, Ron kind of went over this, but I got into the public relations field when I was in the U.S. Coast Guard in Southern California back in the 80s. In fact, one of the bigger cases that I worked back then involved two ships colliding off the coast of Santa Barbara in, I think it was 1987, Pack Baroness. I don't know if anybody remembers that, but big deal, fuel spill, national media attention, CNN, and it's kind of been nonstop since then in terms of, you know, that stuff gets into your blood and you can't leave it behind. So once I got out of the Coast Guard, I went back to school, graduated from San Francisco State with a journalism degree, bounced around as a reporter for a little while. One of the more interesting jobs I had was up in northern Alaska. I ran a newspaper called the Arctic Sounder, which was I think the second northernmost city in the United States, in a place called Kotzebue, Alaska. Fascinating, too cold. I ended up migrating back to the Bay Area, doing some freelance work. Did some freelance work for the Patriot Ledger when I was living back in Boston, down in Quincy. And that's when I got on with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency while I was back there. And Ron is absolutely right. After 7 or 8 New England winters, I was dying to come home. I froze my butt off back there. I mean, it's a beautiful part of the country, but there is nothing quite like California. So when I joined the U.S. EPA in Boston, it was during the Clinton administration, and in spite of the cold, I stayed on because I thought we were doing some pretty exciting things back there. And the political appointee was a guy who had come over from the Dukakis administration. And I thought he was a real visionary. We were working with a lot of interesting folks back there. And so I stayed on until about the end of the Clinton presidency and got them to transfer me back to San Francisco. And I don't think I'm going back to the East Coast. I'm pretty happy to be back here. So, joining the Air Resources Board, as Ron mentioned, I joined the Air Board in July of last year. It's a fascinating agency. For those in the business, those who know the environmental field, the Air Resources Board is the best air agency in the country. I mean, we have led the way on all kinds of things for 40 years now. It's our 40th anniversary. But as we'll talk about in a little bit, I don't think the general public knows that, and much to my chagrin. And I think that's kind of one of the big tasks I'm realizing is kind of the need to brand the Air Resources Board and let more people know about our history, what we've done, and what we're going to continue to do. Because it, you know, the Clean Air Act even has an exemption specifically for California because of all of the things that the Air Resources has done over the years. So there's this recognition that we'll give waivers to the state of California because they will lead the way, other states will adopt, and the U.S. EPA will eventually adopt a lot of the things that start in California. Now, we're having a little bit of a rocky road on that with climate change, as probably some of you have read about the lawsuits with Schwarzenegger and Jerry Brown going after the current administration. But even with that issue, we plan on getting through. So, you know, I had a kind of an interesting first week on the job. During my first week, the chairman of the board was fired. The second in command, the executive director, resigned as a result of that. And so within 2 days of starting, 3 of the 5 people I had interviewed with were gone. And I remember thinking, what did I get myself into up here? I mean, this is, you know, after nearly 20 years as a civil servant with a tremendous amount of job security, I was kind of looking over my shoulder thinking, you know, am I going to be able to pay the rent up here next month? But everything worked out just fine. For those of you who don't know her, a woman named Mary Nichols was appointed as the chairman of the board just a week after I started. And that just made everything okay again. Mary Nichols is an amazing regulatory figure. She's kind of a legend in the environmental field. She's been around for, she actually was the chairman of the board back in the late 70s and early 80s under the Brown administration. And then she was the lead EPA official, the head of the air programs during the formation and implementation of the acid rain program, which is seen as pretty much the most successful cap-and-trade program ever run in this country. So she brings that background to the climate change arena. She had also worked for years and years for NRDC and also UCLA. And so having her start on the job and kind of keep the ball rolling has been really a fortuitous thing for the Air Board. We've fallen in lockstep behind her. She's, again, a true visionary and is carrying our message forth. I run the Office of Communications. We have about 12 people. It's pretty much a traditional press operation. So I think of the 12 people that we have, five of those resources are just putting out press release, are devoted to doing press releases, responding to media interviews, and so on. I inherited a video production specialist. We'll see a little bit of his work here in a second. We've got a graphics, a visual images guy. We have a Spanish-speaking woman, which is, of course, very important in the state now. And we have an outreach function as well. But kind of going back to what I said, we really are kind of a traditional press shop. And the social marketing issue, the behavioral change, is kind of a new thing for us. And so as we talk, I'll be looking forward to kind of hearing some of the things that you guys are up to and then talking about a few of the early steps that we're taking to try and reach out and affect behavior change. So in addition to the Air Resources Board, there is a dizzying array of agencies and outfits that all have their hands in the climate change issue in California. You've got the Air Resources Board, but you've got the California Energy Commission, you've got the Public Utilities Commission, you've got the Department of Natural Resources, the Climate Action Registry, the Western Climate Initiative. You have 35 air districts throughout the state of California, including Mary and Bobby's. And so, you know, there are a lot of folks who have a hand in this, and they are all eager and earnest to get the word out and let people know what they're up to, but it presents a challenge for us. We kind of need to rein everybody in and speak from the same page and kind of preach the same message. So that's been a continuing effort for us and will be for a while. And then when you broaden that scope and you think about all the other folks, I mean, think about the environmental groups that are all doing this. I think you guys, was it an NRDC video that you had talked about with the train, or was that another, the oncoming train?
Environmental Defense.
EDF, right, Environmental Defense. PG&E, so-called Edison. I mean, everybody is out there with a message, and it presents a challenge for us. So I'm going to take a second just to quickly go over what the regulatory program that we are instituting in the state of California. There he is. So Governor Schwarzenegger signed Assembly Bill AB 32 about a year and a half ago, and it really is a forward-thinking, amazing piece of legislation, and we have our work cut out for us on this one. But just quickly, the goals are to reduce to 1990 levels by 2020 the state's greenhouse gas emissions. That's roughly a 25% cut from where we are now. And when you think of numbers, we're talking about, I think the number is 174 million metric tons of greenhouse gas equivalent emissions. That's a lot. And furthermore, he also said by 2050, he wants us to see the state 80% below 1990 levels. So, you know, it would be enough of a challenge if we got to 2020 and just did a collective sigh and said, okay, we're done. But that's just the start, you know, and hopefully we get to 2020 with a lot of momentum because we're going to need it. Now, we're going to do everything we can on the regulatory front to get this done. And developed a series of what are called early action measures. And those are right out of the gate. Here are a few things that we can do. The proverbial low-hanging fruit on, you know, things that aren't going to cause too much of a ruckus that we know we can do early on. They include implementing a low-carbon fuel standard. So the refineries are at work experimenting with blends to bring down the carbon content in fuels sold in the state. To simple things like restrictions on do-it-yourself air conditioning units. I know that sounds like a strange thing, but when you think of all of the, when you do the cumulative effect of all of these things being taken out throughout the state, they translate into a significant amount of emission reductions. And then finally, another one that we announced just late last year was a requirement, it's called a port electrification requirement. And just in a nutshell, what that means is when ships come into harbors like LALB or the Port of Oakland, rather than keeping their diesel engines running, they have to plug in to this huge electrical outlet, this cartoonish-looking electrical outlet at the port. But one of the things that we like about a measure like that is it has what are called co-benefits, and that's one of those things that it makes it all the easier to explain the necessity of a move like that. And when I talk about co-benefits, not only is it reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but it's also reducing diesel pollution, which is great because you've kind of got the here and now pollutants, the ones that are affecting people's health right now, and then you've got tomorrow's in the greenhouse gas emissions. So I think at this point, in terms of, you know, we have this magic number of 174 million metric tons that we need to reduce by the year 2020. I was thinking on our website, I was experimenting with something like one of those old firehouse drives where you could say, okay, we're right here and we're going to get there and we're going to get there. I think we're about a quarter of the way there. We have about a quarter of the emissions accounted for thus far, which is pretty good. So as I mentioned before, we hit a bit of a setback. One of the big measures that we need approval from the U.S. EPA on is a waiver, Clean Air Act waiver, to bring cars to California that emit fewer greenhouse gas emissions out of the tailpipe. This is a huge issue for us. And for the first time in the history of the U.S. EPA, I think we are 49-1 now. The current administration decided not to give us that waiver. They said we didn't have authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions in California. We beg to differ, and we're gonna keep this one going in the courts. We are gonna win, but it is a bit of a speed bump, and we need these reductions sooner rather than later. And so we're working on a plan B. But we are continuing to press the fight back east in court. We've gotten a lot of attention on this one, and in terms of just galvanizing public support, there are a number of other states that are waiting for the California permission to do the same thing. I think about 12 at current count. So as soon as we get the go-ahead to bring cleaner cars to California, a number of other states throughout the country are going to be able to do so. And, you know, just in terms of a media campaign, we had a press conference up in Sacramento. It was kind of surreal to see Jerry Brown and Governor Schwarzenegger arm in arm talking about their fight against the federal government. But as a Californian, I was proud of that. I thought it was great. And it was just a rolling media story. And we saw coverage from around the country. I mean, we saw editorials from the Arizona Republic, from conservative states such as Utah, saying, I think the call was, EPA, get out of the way. And, you know, let the states lead the way, was the kind of the chant. So public opinion is on our side. We have public support. We just need the permission to go ahead with this one. But it's a big, big deal. It's getting a lot of attention, as it should. And, you know, another big thing, just before I jump into the specific communications issues, one other thing that's coming up later this year that's going to be a major announcement is we are going to unveil what's called a scoping plan. And essentially what that is a roadmap to how we are going to reduce this 174 million metric tons by 2020. And it's going to lay out regulations. We're probably going to look at some type of a cap and trade program, market mechanisms, everything under the sun. And we're approaching this sector by sector. So we're meeting with the agricultural industry. We're meeting with the electricity providers. We're meeting with the forestry in terms of carbon sequestration. And what we come up with by the end of the year is going to be a pretty far-ranging document, we imagine. That's when it's going to get difficult in terms of opposition. So, you know, when we're talking about communicating our story, I kind of touched on this earlier, but we're talking about publicizing the regulatory developments via the news media web, et cetera. So we're putting out press releases. We're calling the LA Times. We're keeping the story on the public radar screen. I'll get to that in a second. And then we have the social marketing campaign to go household by household and hit the individuals. Now, that's not part of the law, but that's a huge part of this. I mean, as we're all going to see in the coming years, we're all going to need to change our daily behavior, whether it's through, you know, energy efficiency, the cars we drive, the carpooling we do. This is going to change our society. And I think we're in the right state to be doing this, to start this off, but there's a lot of public support. But once it starts affecting people's values, and their routines. That's where we're going to see some challenges. So in terms of communicating Assembly Bill 32 via the news media, there are a number of positives. We don't need to sell this issue. I mean, reporters are interested. For me, after years and years at the U.S. EPA, I'm like a kid in a candy store at the state of California right now, because they can't wait to talk to us. And we have really good things to say. I mean, we can legitimately say, look, we're leading the way. We're doing this, that, and the other. So, you know, that is a major thing. You know, these reporters, I'm working with the same environmental reporters that I've pretty much been working with for the past 10 years. I don't have to sell this story to Paul Rogers at the Mercury News or Jane Kay at the Chronicle or Margot Roosevelt at the LA Times. They're beating down our door, which is a luxury in my line of work. Everything we do at this point is precedent-setting. And, you know, for those of you who know the news media business, that's always a seller. Superlatives, precedent-setting, you know, if you can say it's first in the nation, that'll get you on TV, that'll get you on radio, that'll get you where you want to be. My staff kind of kid me, because I think when I first started, I used in the lead sentence of the first five or six precedent setting, first in the nation, never been done before, and I've since tempered it a little bit. But you know, if it's true, it's true, and that really does help you. There's no opposition yet. I was even quoted in a couple of early articles saying something to the effect of the response from industry has been muted. It has. We haven't really had much opposition yet. There was a story that came out last week from the environmental justice community. They are vigorously opposed to any type of a cap-and-trade system. They got a little bit of traction on that one. I think this story ran in the LA Times and one in the Sacramento Bee. They did a statewide announcement in five different cities. But that's probably the first opposition we've seen. Now, that's going to change. Again, when the scoping plan comes out, and we are actually proposing regulations on the electricity industry or the ports or cement manufacturers, and it affects their bottom line, that's when we're going to start seeing a little bit of the controversy. The downsides, it's all process at this point. It seems kind of ethereal to some reporters. They're like, well, so you're not actually reducing emissions yet. It's like, well, no, you know, bear with us. This thing doesn't happen overnight. You got to start at the ground level. You got to develop the regulations. You got to involve all the stakeholders. You got to talk to them. You got to take a look at the economic impact of each regulation. It's a long, slow process. But the fact that we're making these commitments is news in itself. And I just kind of have to remind reporters a lot of the times, look, there is going to be a fair amount of process early on. But we are going to get to the point where you're going to see these greenhouse gases going down probably in the next 3 or 4 years. It's hard to come up with visual stories to get on TV. Now, this has long been an issue I've struggled with in working at environmental agencies. The air story is a tough one to sell on TV because it's air. I mean, I don't know, when you watch a typical newscast of an air story, you'll either see cars idling on a freeway or you will see smokestacks. And it's kind of tired. I mean, we've given B-roll footage to state stations throughout the country, throughout the state, showing like good overhead shots of LA and so on. But still, it's a challenge. And so, you know, when we're talking about, because TV is where you reach the most amount of people, and that's hard for a former print reporter to acknowledge, but it's true. So, you know, one of the things that has me really excited is there is a video camera out there right now. It's tremendously expensive, but it can see hydrocarbons. I saw a demo of this about a year ago, and I've been working with the different divisions at our office to try and buy this thing. It costs $80,000. And it's made by a company called FLIR. They do a lot of stuff for the defense agencies. This thing is phenomenal. And when I actually saw a demo of it at the Society of Environmental Journalists conference a couple of years ago, a Portland TV station, I think the Oregon Environmental Agency had one, and they used it to kind of get the media interest in things. But imagine this. So you're watching somebody pump gas through the lens of a regular video camera or even the naked eye. Just looks like somebody pumping gas. Through the lens of this camera, that person is engulfed in black fumes, sinister-looking fumes. It is tremendously effective in really helping people visualize the problem. Now, it's kind of a touchy machine. There are certain settings that don't work and everything, but I am dying to get my hands on one of these things, and I brought the folks up to demo it at our office, and I brought in the folks who have money, the research division and the enforcement division, and I said, you guys could really use this thing, and by the way, if you get it, loan it to us every once in a while. So hopefully within the next few weeks we'll get a hold of one of those things, and then it's just a matter of experimenting to try and figure out, okay, how can we use this to tell the greenhouse gas story? You know, what can we measure? It measures methane very well, so that's one, you know, that's one of the Kyoto gases. And then in terms of visuals, another thing that we're doing is we're going to start doing more and more streaming videos on our website. And, you know, there's a couple of reasons to do this. First off, just to bring movement to your website rather than just static. I mean, if you go to our website, there's a tremendous amount of helpful information there, but it's kind of a wall of text, a couple of photos, a couple of graphics. So my thing is, you know, let's get some movement on there. Let's get pictures, moving pictures that people can see. So there's that benefit. But I've also found in a few cases we've been able to get TV stations to download that and use that as B-roll footage to and use that as our entryway to get the evening story on TV. So I think what I'd like to do now is just show this quick video that we did when we announced the early action measures. We actually did that at the Society of Environmental Journalists conference at Stanford this year. Mary Nichols did a press conference. So this kind of gives you a sense of what we're doing early on. Uh-oh. No, it didn't work. Uh-oh. Now this should. Nope. Oh, well. I'll try and show it later. Maybe I'll show it at the end to give you guys a sense. I'll just keep plowing ahead. So social affecting behavior change, social marketing, this is kind of our weak link. This is where we need a little bit of help. I think, you know, in running a traditional press operation for a long time, we're good at that. We're good at getting on TV and radio and in the pages, in the newspapers. But This is kind of a new thing for us. And, you know, it occurred to me, since I've taken this job, I've talked to a lot of people, some in the know, very in the know about the environmental business, others not so much. And I've kind of come away with the conclusion that the Air Resources Board could well be the most important public agency most Californians have never heard of. And that's tremendously distressing for me. So I have taken that as kind of a personal challenge to get the word out on what we're doing and to really make the link. One of the social marketing things that we're experimenting with right now is this Climate Champions program, where we're recruiting teenagers across the state to kind of do social networking via Facebook, MySpace, and all that. And these kids had done a lot of research leading up to the interviews. They all knew, well, not all of them, a good amount of them knew about Schwarzenegger showing leadership and everything, but no mention of their resources board. And this was a pretty educated group. So that's kind of a bigger thing that we need to address up in Sacramento. In terms of social marketing and behavioral change, there are a few things that we need to see. And these, as we'll see in a chart here in a second, I'll explain the importance of this. But energy efficiency, this is huge. This can be a huge part of the puzzle for Californians. Smarter land use decisions at the local level. This one's particularly interesting because environmental regulators for years and years have kind of wrung their hands, how do we get at this suburban sprawl issue? You know, there was no real mechanism to affect change. The The incentive on the part of cities and towns is to expand their tax base, move further out, and get more tax dollars. And there just isn't a strong, there hasn't been strong enough of a deterrent or another set of incentives to curb that and to get them to develop inward rather than outward. So we might finally have the mechanism in AB 32. We'll see. And then finally, fewer vehicle miles traveled. That's going to be a huge part of trying to get us to lower our overall carbon footprint in the state. So here you can see why. This is, and the scientists wrote this one, 480 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent is what that means at the top. But you see the sources here. Transportation, nearly 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions in this state come from transportation. That's higher than the national average if you look at the inventory across the country, because we have a love affair with the automobile here in California that's kind of hard to kick. And then you see electricity generation imports and in-state. You combine those two and you get another 25%. So when we're talking about affecting behavior change, we got two pretty ripe targets right there. And then I guess you would even fold in the residential into the electricity generation. And when we're talking about vehicle miles traveled, that also, of course, gets into the whole, you know, the suburban sprawl issue as well, because we're trying to create shorter commutes for people. So a few of the early efforts that we have underway to affect behavior change include, this is a biggie, and I'm sorry I don't have a better thing to kind of share with you guys on this, but with 2009 model year cars in California starting, and this is, they're going to start hitting the showroom, I believe, around September or something, all cars in California are going to be required to carry a sticker that shows their environmental performance. So there'll be a smog score, which currently exists. That's something that's a labeling issue here in California already, but there'll be a global warming score. Now, that is a huge consumer awareness tool that we really want to do a lot of work in doing outreach on. I'm seeing going to doing a media event in L.A., one in Sacramento, one in the Bay Area, and really, and this is a visual thing, too. Again, you know, you can just imagine watching the evening news and seeing the camera pan in on this thing and showing the sticker and maybe taking a look at a Prius juxtaposed with a Cadillac Escalade or something like that. So that is one that hopefully we'll be able to get a lot of, pardon the pun, mileage out of. It's a great consumer awareness tool, but that's just one of many. Another thing that we're going to, that is not something that we're spearheading, but I think is very important. I'm drawing a blank on the name of the legislature who's sponsoring this, but there's a state bill that's currently working its way through Sacramento that would bring global warming to classroom curricula. Now, I think it's being taught in a lot of schools as part of an environmental sciences program, but it doesn't really stand out and apart. And interviewing these potential climate champions over the weekend, almost to a person, kids all said, you know what, we need a new curriculum in school. We need this to be taught in the schools. So that'll be an important thing. And obviously, kids and future generations, those are the ones who are going to be affected the most, so we need to bring it into the classroom. We're creating a toolkit for local governments, and this is going to be kind of a checklist of things that they can do to lower their respective carbon footprint. And then this Climate Champions program, this is going to take us into the world of Facebook and MySpace and YouTube and everything else. This is modeled after a program run in the UK in which we select a certain amount of, I think we're going to have 15 California climate champions. They're teens from 16 to 18 who are aware, who are good spokespeople, they're good ambassadors. They care about the issue, they're already doing something, they're running an environmental club at school, you know, they're talking to their local city council. And we are going to kind of use them to kind of do the social networking throughout the state with their peers. It was a remarkable weekend that I had. I had to work Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday too. We did about 40 interviews, a bunch in Sacramento, and then I came down to LA and did a bunch more. I was heartened to see the passion, the dedication, and the sophistication on the part of high school students. I mean, now granted, I don't think these kids were representative of the entire student body, but man, they made me look bad. At 16, I wasn't anywhere near as impressive as that. So, and you know, the one consistent thing we heard from a lot of these students were, we had a set list of questions that we asked them about, you know, how'd you become aware, what are you doing, you know, what would you tell a world leader if you had an opportunity to affect change? And to a person, every one of those kids said they became aware of climate change by seeing an inconvenient truth. It's amazing. I'm writing a letter to Al Gore when I get back to Sacramento to tell him that. I mean, I know the guy gets a lot of positive reinforcement, as he should, but that really left an impression on me. I mean, that's a PowerPoint made into a movie. It's amazing. And then finally, the other tool that we're going to be rolling out here in the next couple of months is a carbon calculator. Now, there are a lot of carbon calculators out there, and we've struggled to really create one that is going to be different from all the rest and is unique to California. And it's a challenge because there are a lot of good ones out there, and ironically, the US EPA actually has a pretty good one. So we're going to be rolling that out. You know, that's going to be a big thing that we offer up to these climate champions for them to bring into their schools, take a look at their respective carbon footprints, those of their classmates, and maybe even a school-wide carbon footprint. And what's going to set this one apart is that it's California-specific in that we talk to SoCal Edison, we talk to the Sacramento Municipal Utilities District, we talk to PG&E. So we've got geographic-specific information in terms of electricity costs, because ours are different here in the state of California. And then secondly, I believe, I would need to double-check this, but I think it's going to be the only bilingual one in the country that's out there, which is tremendously important here in California. Kind of going back to who your audience is and who you're trying to reach, you know, the Latino population in this state and the ways to reach that particular segment of society, you know, that's a huge issue. A couple of months ago, the Chronicle had a story that said, I think it was Univision in the Bay Area, topped the Nielsen ratings for the first time out of all local newscasts. I think that's happened a lot in L.A. before, but never in the Bay Area. I mean, that's a huge deal. So Fox, NBC, ABC, CBS, were more people watched Univision than any of them. And, you know, so when we were creating this carbon calculator, I said, look, we need to distinguish ourselves because there are other ones out there, and one of the things we need to do is we need to make this bilingual because, you know, that's a huge segment in this society and that we need to reach. So I think that kind of wraps it up for me. There's a screenshot of kind of where we are with the carbon calculator right now. We've been working with UC Berkeley on this one as well as Next10. In developing this thing. And it's going to be a .org. We'll link off of our .gov site and send people there. It's going to get better and better. We're not quite where we want to be yet. Eventually, we want to get to the point where, you know, you go into the energy use area and it will list stores within your zip code where you can go buy compact fluorescents or energy efficient devices, solar panels, that type of thing. So I think come September or so, we'll be at that point. But right now, we're going to do an early rollout. And then finally, here's just a little more information. on, you know, kind of some of our information repositories. We have a listserv if people want to know about upcoming workshops or notifications or public notices that we're putting out, as well as coming events. And that's me down on the right on how to reach me. So, okay. And
thank you for this informative, wonderful presentation. My question would be whether or not you have been targeting public transportation at all.
Oh yeah, actually, and you know, we're targeting them in a number of ways, and you know, I think Bobby and Mary are probably working with the local transit agencies here in Santa Barbara as well. But one of the things we're doing is giving grants to get them to run on, obviously get off diesel, but also get over to CNG or hydrogen. And we just had a press conference announcing a new hydrogen fuel bus down in San Mateo. So we're trying to encourage the use of all alternative fuels is one thing that.
I'm sorry. What I meant, I probably didn't formulate myself. Well, oh. What I meant was to
get more writers,
target the public to use.
Yes.
Public transportation.
I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. I jumped ahead of myself. Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, a big thing that when we're talking about common sense public measures that you can do in the social marketing thing, public transit is a huge deal. I mean, we're saying, you know, leave the car at home, get on the bus. Now, there are better transit systems in certain parts of the states than others. So, you know, our call, and I think the policymakers at their Air Resources Board and at the air districts, is to continue to try and make it as convenient as possible. And, you know, it's, people don't take it if it's not convenient. If you have to transfer three times, and you can get there in your car in 20 minutes, and you transfer three times, and you get there in an hour and a half, that's just not good enough. So, yeah, it's a matter of trying to make it as convenient as possible and really give them the additional time and financial incentives for taking it as well.
Thank you. You've done a wonderful job here.
So no, thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I have a question because I'm a teacher, and mm-hmm. we talk a lot about developing a communication plan. Mm-hmm. And the reality, I'm just curious, do you have a communication plan? How many people work on it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how
mm-hmm.
flexible is it?
It's right up here. and... you know, it's interesting. I was thinking about this, especially in terms of the media approach. My strategy is what I refer to as the machine gun strategy, and that is don't let them tell them everything you were doing. So when I was at the U.S. EPA, we put out a tremendous amount of press releases. Every enforcement case we took, every new study, everything that had a news hook, we would do a press release on. So I think we were about 240 press releases per year, thereabouts. And, you know, it's not obviously enough just to put out a press release, but we had a 95% pickup rate. So we weren't putting out news just for the sake of putting out news. And there were a lot of times, what you'll find at a regulatory agency is that people will come to you, well-intentioned people will come up to you and say, hey, we've just established a partnership with so-and-so. You know, no, that's not enough, you know. So what's the news hook? You know, that's the thing. And this machine gun approach is just to remind people where their taxpayer dollars are being spent and to keep it on the public consciousness. And you know, by extension, not just getting in the Oakland Tribune is great, but I'm also trying to think visually on all of these things and think, okay, let's get to the mainstream paper. Maybe that'll drive TV coverage. Maybe it won't. Maybe we need to kind of sell that with more visuals. What's the angle on radio? How can we get them involved? So that's kind of the, I know that's not the specifics that you were probably looking for, but, you know, a friend of mine had a tagline on his email that I really liked, and it was, if it ain't in the news, it didn't happen. And I believe that. I think that, you know, if you operate in a vacuum and you don't tell people what you're up to, you know, you're shooting yourself in the foot. You need public support. You need to remind people what their taxpayer dollars are being spent on.
Sure. Over here. You said something about the fact that when the rubber's really going to hit the road is when we really ask people to start changing their behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand all the PR that you're doing is to let people know about what the ARB is doing and how great it is, but the question you were asked earlier was, so are people doing anything?
Right.
Have you done any focus groups or any feelings on what it takes to get people, beyond getting it in the newspaper,
it
actually take to get people to change their behaviors?
Right.
A little bit beyond having the government do the work.
That's a very good question. And here's kind of what we're up against. I recognize that that's a weakness on our part. That's where we need some help, and that's why we're kind of reaching out to the climate champions. That's where we're going to work with Mary and Bobby at all the air districts. That is not really our expertise. It needs to be. We're learning, but it hasn't been, and it's been a weak spot for us. And traditionally, a lot of the good public education programs or campaigns that you've seen to raise awareness have involved bringing in an outside consultant, a PR consultant. And, you know, that's a mixed bag. I think, like the Flex Your Power campaign, I think they contracted out. You know, that's very recognizable. I think I can even see the little, you know, cartoon with the thing. But short of hiring an outside consultant, you know, I think we are kind of wrestling with how do we do this with the talent and the resources we have in-house. And we're struggling. I mean, frankly, it's that's a good question. I mean, we do, we don't necessarily do the focus groups so much. I think there's a real need, but I also am aware that I think it's kind of a double-edged sword going outside and hiring a PR contract, especially when your state's having a budget crisis. And you know, there's a real public perception issue. The Bush administration has gotten in a lot of trouble over, I think, the Healthy Forest campaign. They did a bunch of video news releases, tremendous backlash. So, I mean, that's an issue we have to figure out how to deal with.
Connected with that, there are tremendous resources that are untapped already, and I'm glad you're doing it with the high school champions. But for example, the Bren School does group projects with the students, and there must be ways to get yourselves not only into to the environmental departments, but to the art departments for assistance for the film studies, for the video making, who could really make the informational type of stuff that you're doing a lot sexier.
Yeah.
And also very much more intelligently directed to who's your audience.
Yeah.
You know, are you
speaking to
adults of some sophisticated knowledge of climate change, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And there is cheap labor. And there's real science, too.
All right. Here is, I brought along business cards, and anybody who wants to contact me, we're looking for help, and that would be great. And I think that's a logical place to go.
If you did a coordinated outreach to UCLA, to Caltech, all over the place, you're going to get buy-in. You're going to get people interested because the the professors are more interested now than ever. The students are asking for application proof.
Yeah.
And your communication department here with tremendous theory on what creates social change.
Yeah.
And I'd also like to know the state bill, please, that's getting curriculum into schools.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry, I don't have that. I think I'll find out.
Okay, great. And one of the things I would suggest is get a character, get an ARB character. You mentioned the Flex Your Power.
Mm-hmm.
You need some visual that's fun, communicates, whatever. Do that. And if you're going to get school champions, get sports team champions.
Yeah.
Get the lead quarterbacks behind you. ARB with so-and-so. You can have Chuck, what's his name, with that idiot politician. You guys can have someone too.
Yeah, Chuck Norris.
And do you use PSAs, public service announcements?
We do, actually. And you know where we're using public service announcements in particular is we have a diesel regulation out right now aimed at port trucks, drayage trucks. They're huge diesel polluters. But the drivers don't make a hell of a lot of money. They're kind of beholden to larger folks, and we're requiring retrofits and replacements. We have to do a huge public outreach campaign. Traditionally, Latinos comprise most of these drivers in low-income areas. And, you know, a story in the L.A. Times isn't going to reach these folks. So we're looking at, particularly in L.A., we're doing PSAs and reaching out to the radio stations and TV stations is kind of our primary mode of reaching them. But, yeah, I mean, it's kind of who's our audience for each one of these things? What's the best way to reach them? And then, you know, is English the best language?
Right.
Yeah, but I appreciate your comments. You're right on the mark. And I think, the more help we can get at the university level, the happier we'd be. That's right. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jane Breckwell with the American Lung Association, and we are your ally by all means. We have a lobbyist working full time up there in Sacramento, and working with you in terms of AB.
Bonnie Holmstein.
Yeah, I know Bonnie. Yeah. I had a few thoughts. I know I drive a hybrid, and providing incentives. Tax incentives, rebates, whatever work.
Mm-hmm. We just did an announcement on that last week, actually, but it was a bit flawed because I came to realize I thought it was going to be a movement encouraging people to buy alt fuel vehicles. Well, it turns out all of the car dealerships had been telling them that this rebate program was coming, so all the money's already spoken for.
Yeah.
That kind of cut the legs out from under us when we put the press release out last week. I was like, wait, I thought this was going to be a driver to get more people to purchase vehicles, but this money's already pretty much spoken. But you're right, rebates.
Yeah. And I have a question. The EPA did not give the waiver. So, but we're continuing on. I mean, you proceed to talk about all the things we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
How does that impact us, and are you ignoring it, or, I mean, what?
Oh, no.
I'm really kind of confused.
You know,
about
here's
that.
The thing, and you know, we're pretty realistic about it. We are confident that when it does make its way to the court, we're going to win. And, you know, EPA attorneys said as much. When the internal memos came out, Washington Post leaked the story. You know, there was a widespread agreement among staff at the US EPA that you need to grant, that the guidance to the administrator was you need to grant this waiver, we're going to lose in court. So, but now this could get dragged on for a while, and realistically we might have to wait until next February until somebody new comes into the White House. And if it stalls, and so with that recognition, that's where the plan B comes in. We're looking at other ways that we can bring these car company cleaner cars to California without the waiver. So we're plowing ahead kind of on two or three fronts with contingency plans.
Thank you.
Hi, I don't have a good visual for the Air Resources Board, but I can give you a great sound bite that I heard.
Okay, all right.
I think it was 2 years ago that the Governance for Sustainable Development people at the Bren School of Environmental Science and Management organized a California University Summit on Climate Change. And one of the speakers, and you have to find out who this guy is, I think he was a professor at Berkeley. Maria might know. She was one of the people who helped organize this.
Mm-hmm.
It was in response to a question after his talk about peak oil. And he said, oh, we're going to run out of air before we run out of oil.
Yeah, that's pretty dramatic.
Yeah. So you might be able to track him down. I'm sure Maria
could
find out who he is and you know, get him on camera doing that. The other thing I wanted to comment on, I love the sticker that are going to be on all new cars and the carbon calculator.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me remember that if you go on the Adbusters website, you can print out a traffic citation, like a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
It looks exactly like a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And what it has on it is it's a fine. I think it's about $80,000. And it's the cost of what it how much it takes to run your car, like right. all the cost of the environment, yeah, health, yeah. and all that. And I was just thinking that if the carbon calculator could be put together with that,
mm-hmm.
you could find under your windshield wiper a ticket that would calculate the exact cost of running your car.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. Not just a generic cost.
You know, I like that idea. However, issuing the tickets, we might look at our friends from the American Lung Association or another partner to kind of do, because that might be seen as a bit radical for the state government, but I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
One of the subtexts has been at the individual level, and you're moving into behavior change and attitude change as mm-hmm. well. And the traditional communications office approach, as you said, from a traditional newspaper and media approach, is, mm-hmm. is placement.
Right.
Press releases, coverage, stories. Mm-hmm. And you can measure those, and I'm sure that you do.
Mm-hmm.
At the individual and the social marketing component, if you have to have attitude change, you have to have
right.
individual behavior change, and along with that, you have to have data on that. That is, the assumption is you have all these messages out there, and people read them,
mm-hmm.
and apart from the public policy changes, individuals change.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, do you have any mechanism in place to measure that, to begin to assess how effective you are at, in fact, changing those attitudes, much
you know,
less the individual behaviors?
Yeah, no. Sadly, we don't. And, you know, it's interesting. Having been in government for a while, it's been an adjustment moving over to the state because I've learned about, among other things, some of the hiring practices. In other terms, what skill sets you can bring into the state at state government. And one of the things I always tried to do at the US EPA, when I had an opening for a press officer, I went after former newspaper reporters just because they could work on deadline, they understood the issues, they could write fast and clearly, good communicators. I can't do that at the state. There is a strange system in place that has an information officer exam. And so when I was looking to hire a climate change information officer, I had to just look at the pool of people within state government who had passed that information officer exam. And, you know, there are a lot of good folks out there, but it's somewhat limiting. So kind of bringing that back to the question you asked, Ron, is we just don't have the job classifications or the talent at that in that field. And, you know, I could probably free up some of my staff and provide them with the training, but that kind of gets back to, again, do we, you know, look to our friends at the UC system to help us with that? I'm leery of going the PR consultant route. So, yeah, maybe we'll be talking more and more.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.